we have new members, and the new members are dynamic individuals from the community who are willing to give their all.
So you're encouraged?
Very encouraged.
Very good. The show has been tribute. I'm Susan Donaldson. I've been speaking to Louisa Terry Monahan about the Long Island Explorium. This is a hands-on children's museum that is in the planning stages here on Long Island. Thank you for being my guest, Louisa.
Thank you for having me.
The preceding program was a pre-recorded presentation of WUSB, Stony Brook.
Good afternoon. It's Monday again, and this is Chatterbox, the hour-long call-in talk program where you, our listeners, are invited to give us a call, or two, with your questions, comments, criticisms, etc. I'm Eric Corley, and like I said, we'll be here for an hour talking about all kinds of interesting things. I'll introduce our guest for today in just a moment. First, I'd like to remind you that every day at this time, every weekday at this time, we have a similar type of call-in program. Some are designed for specific purposes, such as tomorrow, when you can catch a really nifty business program with Art Dietrich. On Wednesday, a health program with Barbara Bloom. Thursday, new music with Jim Caligiuri. And on Friday, some more stuff with Good Afternoon Long Island and Bill Camarda. All talk programs, they all take place from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. here on USB. Our telephone number is 246-7901, area code 516. If you race for the phones now, you just might be our first caller. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest for today. We have in our studios a real live editor of a newspaper. What newspaper? It's the Stony Brook Press. That's right. Now, in case you haven't heard about the Stony Brook Press, that is a publication on the campus of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Comes out once a week on Thursdays, and it's the second of two newspapers, not second in quality or anything like that, but the second in that they came after the first newspaper. The first newspaper is called Statesman, and they come out 3 days a week. Well, with that, Joe Capone, editor of the Stony Brook Press. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Good afternoon, Eric.
And how has editing the Stony Brook Press this year been so far? This is your first year doing it as far as actually being editor-in-chief. Mm-hmm. Actually, I guess most editors only do it for a year.
Press editor's term runs for 1 year. I took over in June, and we put out the first summer Stony Brook Press that we've had in our 4 years of existence, put out a few issues over the summer. And now we're into the school year. It's pretty much what I expected it to be. It's very interesting, takes up enormous amounts of time, and keeps me very busy.
Uh-huh.
We've been working on a lot of things lately, both on campus and off. We're very interested in some.
Were you around when the press was first started, when they first broke away from Statesman?
No, that was, I was in high school at that point. That was in the fall of 1979. A number of statesman editors, including their managing editor, which is the number two man on the paper, had decided that they wanted to do something different. They thought they could put out a better paper without a lot of the restraints that are just built into a paper of the size and tradition of statesmen. And they moved off and put out their own paper. In fact, we had our fourth anniversary issue just last week. We went over a lot of the history. And it was surprising when I came here in the fall of 1980, the press was only about 9 months old, but I didn't become aware of that until a couple of years later. I thought both papers went equally far back because I thought they were both equally important on campus.
How, if, I assume there's a difference. What do you see that difference as being?
Well, The Statesman is an event-oriented, almost daily paper. Of course, it's three times a week, but it's styled on the style particularly of Newsday, whereas the press takes, the press is able to take a longer view at things coming out once a week. Its founders had papers like the Village Voice in mind, although we like to also look at the news weekly magazines for guidance.
And what kind of stories do you look for?
Well, we look for, the press has done in its years a lot of in-depth investigations of things you don't see in your everyday paper. We've done large series on racism. We've done stories about the university's mental health policies, which led to those policies being changed. We do investigations into ways to improve student life on campus and ways to improve life all around. We're active, try and be active in the political sphere outside of campus. We've covered elections, interviewed Abby Hoffman, Ralph Nader.
They've come to campus, those people. I see. The press always came out on Thursdays?
Press always came out on Thursdays.
Why Thursday? Was there something special about that day?
Thursday was one of the 2 days that Statesman wasn't coming out during the school term, and Thursday is a better day. It's certainly for advertising, not that we have much, but for advertising,
why is that?
It's much better to, you get the weekend market.
Why do you think you don't have much advertising?
Because, well, as a young paper, and we're only 4 years old, we have, and a student-run paper, we have no full-time paid positions. We don't have an advertising director. We hope to bring in a lot of these things in the future, but at this point we're still trying to get the very basics rolling steadily. We've been proud of our newspaper quality, the quality of the stories and the photographs, but we're trying to build up the business end in order to sustain the paper, and then hopefully we'll see a lot more advertising.
Now, what kind of funding do you get to start with, so that you can survive without advertising to an extent?
Well, the press, like WSBI, is funded in large measure out of undergraduate student activity fees. We get a certain amount of money from Polity every year, and they've been...
Polity is the student government here.
Yes, okay. And they've been reasonably generous. We've never gotten everything we wanted, but we've gotten most of the things we needed. And the other funding comes in basically through advertising. We do a number of smaller jobs, such as typesetting for other publications on campus, which brings in a little bit of money.
Okay, we're going to get to another point in a moment. Let me just say our phone number is 246-7901. I see all of our lines are lit up. I'm not sure if that's calls for us or what. Oh, they just all went out. I don't know what's going on in there. But if someone's in there making outgoing calls, please don't do that. We need those lines. Area code 516-246-7901 is our phone number. We have Joe Capone, who is the editor, managing editor, is that the official title?
Executive editor.
Oh, I'm sorry, executive editor of the Stony Brook Press. Now, one thing you have to deal with as editor is a lot of talking to administration figures. Now, how do you deal with that? What's the diplomatic way And have you run into I'm sure you've run into difficulties. Could you outline some of those without getting too many people in trouble?
Well, it runs into a problem that you don't face. Normal larger newspapers have governments that they have to deal with and report on, but they aren't connected to that government in any way. They are funded independently of the government, and they don't work for in any sense. So they have a lot more, not freedom, but say a lot less fear of what they can do. The press, on the other hand, is funded through, in large measure, through the student government, and also its writers, its staff are all undergraduates at the university, and as such they have to deal not only as reporters but as students with administration in a lot of ways, and it becomes a problem. You get to know the administrators, get to know the vice presidents fairly well. You get to talk to them on a first name basis, but you still, I mean, they've been here for so much longer. They're going to be here for a lot longer than any student journalist will be. So it takes a lot more work on the student's part to keep up with what they've been doing and what they've done. A great deal of our work is just studying what happened before we got here, because from that we are able to figure out what they're doing now.
What are they doing now?
Well, in a lot of things, they're just continuing on regular administrative practices. The administration's concern, and it's a valid one, is they want to make the university look as good as possible to the outside world. They want to save as much money as possible so that they can spend it on things that they feel are good for the university.
What kind of things?
Well, let me say, as students, on the other hand,
yeah,
we're equally interested in a lot of these things. We want the university to look good, although it's not a major concern. We want the university to save money in areas where it can save the money and spend them in other areas. But this dichotomy of viewpoint between students and administrators becomes evident when you start talking about specific programs. The university will cut faculty lines in order to use that money in other areas. One thing we're working on a lot now at the press is on dorm cooking. At Stony Brook University, students are able to cook their own food in the dorms. This is a unique program, pretty much unheard of at most other universities, and we think it's a very good one. But it's costing administration more than a mandatory meal plan would, and they're interested in putting as many people on the meal plan, by hook or by crook, as they can. And where we'd like to see the money stay, keeping the dorm cooking program around.
Now, dorm cooking is a big issue here on campus. First of all, could you describe the program, what dorm cooking is, for people who don't go to this school?
Well, about 10 years ago, and for the first 15 years of the university's existence, all resident students were on a mandatory meal plan. That is, they paid so many hundreds of dollars at the beginning of the semester and went to cafeterias every day for their meals. And then about 10 years ago, there was a strike of the cooking workers, and all of a sudden there was no meal plan. Students were forced to cook for themselves, to go to off-campus restaurants, which suddenly became jammed, and they started complaining back to administration. So very quickly, administration put up stoves and dishwashers, refurbished the sinks in the student residential buildings. And students began cooking for themselves. They have a certain amount of stove space. They have the electrical capacity to plug in ovens. They have their larger ovens already in there. They have dishwashers. And finally, when the cooking workers went back off their strike, they found that not a whole lot of people wanted to go back onto dorm cooking. Didn't want to go back onto the meal plan. And so for the last about 10 years, we've had this program. And right now, about 3/4 of the resident students here are not on the meal plan. They do their own cooking.
3/4?
That's something like 70%.
And is that comparable anywhere else in the SUNY school, or?
Well, most universities, no, it's very rare. Most universities have a mandatory meal plan for all resident students. And what you'll see happening is that students will live on campus their freshman, their sophomore years, and then particularly if they live in a more metropolitan area than this, they'll move off campus. And in moving off campus, of course, they are obliged to cook for themselves. Stony Brook is different. There aren't a whole lot of places to move off campus. And most upperclassmen don't want to move off campus. They want to stay on campus because that's where they choose to live, but they also want to cook for themselves, just to save money for their own convenience, for a lot of reasons.
Now, in the pages of the Stony Brook Press, I've seen accusations that administration here at Stony Brook is trying to force students back onto the meal plan. I've been hearing this for years. Is it really happening? Are they making headway? What's going on?
Well, administration, particularly recently, has seemed to have stepped up its efforts to get students onto the meal plan. Currently, students pay, depending on where they live, in what building, anywhere between $65 and $100 a semester for the privilege of doing their own cooking. Now, out of this dorm cooking fee, certain things are supposed to be paid for, upkeep on the stoves and such, extermination, various costs that administration has to carry. Just recently, now this has gone up tremendous amount in just the last few years. Only 4 years ago it was $25 a semester. In fact, only 3 years ago it was $25 a semester, and it's gone up to between $65 and $100 now. Next semester, that is in January, it'll be increased by another third.
You say $65 to $100? I mean, it's different for different people?
In the Stony Brook has two kinds of residence halls. There are what we call the halls, which are dormitory style. That's two people to a room on a long hall with 18 rooms. And at the end of the hall, there are stoves and ovens and dishwashers. And those people have to pay $100 a semester, $200 a year. The other way to live is in four- or six-person suites, which are two people to a room, but each rooms are grouped into three dormitory rooms with a central room, and this room has a cooking hood, basically, and that's all. There's dishwashers down the hall. These people only pay $65 a semester. I say only in comparison to what the people in the halls pay.
Well, now it seems that the people who are paying less get a better deal than the people who are paying more, because they have things right in their own area, the living area.
Well, the people in the suites don't have the stove facilities. They don't have ovens.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They get basically a table bolted into the wall and a stove hood above it.
From what I've been reading in the press, though, those ovens that you're supposed to be paying for don't usually or don't sometimes exist.
There's a lot of problems with them. Upkeep is not good, although it seems to be getting better. There is one stove to a hall. Often there's one stove shared between two halls, which is almost 100 people. So, A, when they do work, the stoves are very hard to get to. You can imagine 100 people trying to use four stove burners or one oven. And if they break or if they're vandalized, repairs tend to take a long time, and the people are stuck until they're fixed.
Do those repairs take a long time because administration is trying to punish people for vandalism?
Well, it could be. Certainly if a stove is vandalized consistently after it's repaired, and that happens very little on campus, there'll be a significant lag in time. I know one hall had its stoves removed for a year. Another hall in one of our buildings, a wall collapsed near the stoves. The wall was just poorly built, and after 20 years of use, it just kind of fell down.
That's not what the administration said. They said that wall was pushed.
Well, it was pushed. It was the wall in question was probably leaned against and quite possibly even hit, but if you hit a wall in your house, it won't fall down.
Uh-huh.
It was... And from what I saw of the wall after it came down, it was pretty well collapsed.
Now, something like that, the wall collapsing, sounds like a pretty serious violation of some sort, a certain safety violation. Now, I don't recall seeing the press when that happened, but what kind of questions did you ask the administration How could a wall fall down in a dormitory?
Well, they're basic.
Are we talking about cinder blocks here?
Yes.
Someone could have been killed with those.
Certainly. A cinder block wall. Well, of course, like you said, the administration blamed it largely on vandalism. But we feel basically the wall was probably just really poorly made and underwent upwards of 20 years of use. But
is there any evidence to indicate that?
Well, most of the walls, or certainly many walls in that quad, in that set of buildings that were all built at the same time, are in similar condition. They're dried up, they're cracked, cracking.
So you're saying another wall could fall down? Then?
Certainly, at any time. But the upshot of this was that the students on that hall weren't able to cook on that hall, although the stoves had not been damaged.
Okay, I think more importantly than the fact that they can't cook is the fact that another wall could fall down at any moment in those buildings. Now, we're talking about the old-style dormitory buildings here, mm-hmm. known as G and H squads on campus. Now, what has the administration been doing to prevent this from happening again?
As far as I know, nothing.
Uh-huh.
They've been, each building has its own RHD in charge, and they're supposed to watch out for these things, but there's really not a whole lot of way you can tell if a wall is going to spontaneously collapse.
As the editor of a paper, don't you feel that's one of the most pressing responsibilities, to let people know that nothing is being done to prevent a cinder block wall from collapsing inside a dormitory building?
Certainly.
What kind of authorities can are supposed to oversee this? Is it the dormitory authority?
Well, it is the dormitory authority. Students are in an unusual legal situation if they want to get any recompense from that, in that they are not considered tenants, although they do pay semesterly rent. They're not considered tenants by the state, and they don't have the rights of tenants, in such that I don't believe that they can sue the dormitory authority for damages. They certainly can't try and reclaim any money they've spent, and they can't reclaim any damages from the collapse of walls or from anything else in the dormitories.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Also, that brings to light the fire last year over in the storage building. What was the official name of that building?
The commissary.
It burned the building to the ground. It was set by one of our fire marshals. And what was revealed, I believe, in the pages of the Stony Brook Press, and maybe some other papers too, was the fact that the university knew that building was a fire hazard, and yet nothing had been done about it, because there wasn't money to do something about it.
Well, it was found afterwards that the building was stocked with various supplies, plastic bags, toilet paper, way beyond its legal limits. There are laws on storage, and such laws say that, for instance, that your aisles have to be so many inches wide, and in fact the things were packed so that they were only a small fraction of that width, and there has to be a certain amount of space between the tops of the piles of material and the ceiling, and that space didn't exist. And the reasons for these rules are that fire won't be able to ram through a building as quickly as it did that one. The university claimed that they didn't have the storage space in which to put all these things, but they found they lost quite a bit more in the fire.
Do you see any evidence that they won't let something like that happen again?
Well, the university, like any other business, is attempting to cut corners, to maximize, to take money out from where its use is not so well seen. People don't see when you're violating fire rules in a storage building until the building burns down and you lose everything in it.
Or until a wall collapses. What other instances of negligence can you bring up by the administration here?
Well, among the buildings, there are... The buildings themselves are typically just in very poor condition. I'm thinking there are lots of other ways in which there's a certain hard-heartedness among the university. I referred before to something we'd done on medical suspension. It had been found that if a student was considered suicidal or depressed, who would just be dismissed by the university. The university would send them a note saying, we think you're a danger to yourself and the people that live with you, get out of our university. Uh-huh. A year ago, that was after a series of press articles, that was changed so that now the university will attempt to find out what it can do to help the person before just kicking them out of the university. Uh-huh. In addition, students campus-wide are just very worried about the quality of their living conditions. As I said before, there are what we call residence hall directors, which are paid staff members in each building, and a lot of students consider that these RHDs are encroaching on their rights as Americans. RHDs can key into someone's dorm room anytime they wish, which is something not even the police can do.
Well, now I've heard of cases where landlords can walk into tenants' rooms. I'm not exactly sure of the legalities of that, but you're saying residence hall directors can do that with more freedom than any other?
Fairly much at will. The actual rules, not the contract, because it's not an official state contract, but the agreement that's signed by residents states that an RHD will give 24 hours notice before they wish to go into someone's room. But it also states in a clause that in case of emergencies, they can go right in. Now, emergency is up to the RHD, uh-huh. And typically any fire drill will be considered an emergency for them to go into rooms looking for either people trying to hide out from having pulled the fire alarm or look for anything else they may choose to search.
Uh-huh. I see. So you consider that a violation of tenants' rights, but students don't have the status of tenants.
That's right. Students should have the status of tenants because they are paying rent.
Let me just remind our listeners that this is a call-in program. If you want to give us a call with your questions, our telephone number is 246-7901, area code 516. We were scheduled originally to have Robert Matheson, who is the independent candidate for Suffolk County Legislature, or actually Suffolk County Executive, I'm sorry, on this program. He will be on next week, so you can call up and ask him all kinds of questions next week. It's Robert Matheson. This week we have Joe Capone, who is the editor of the Stony Brook Press here on campus. And, editing a newspaper is certainly, it can be a lot of fun from what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
You have unique situations. Have you encountered many of those?
Well, perhaps certainly you encounter them all the time. In large measure, just as part of your position as being an editor, the president of a corporation, as both of the newspapers are, dealing with administrators. Dealing with administrators, other students. Is that when administration will be obliged to throw media receptions and bring all the student media in for drinks. Just the Javits reception we had here 2 weeks ago, where former Senator Javits donated his business is Senate papers to the university, was an occasion for all this. It was a great occasion for all the student media. There were seven current United States senators here, and we had occasions to just walk up to them as Dan Rather would and say, "Good afternoon, Senator. What do you think about this?"
Uh-huh. Did you do that?
Yes, we did.
Did they talk back?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It was very enlightening, a very fun day. My only regret is Governor Cuomo was here, and he left by helicopter before we were able to approach him with many questions.
And such as? What questions would you like to ask?
Well, Governor Cuomo was here a year ago when he was a candidate and promised an audience here that his education was one of his top priorities. He would not make any cuts in either funding to the universities or in student financial aid. And as the press wrote in an editorial, Governor Cuomo made education a priority. It was the first thing he cut.
Uh-huh.
We wanted to ask him about how he felt coming back on that, but he helicoptered away before he had much of a chance to speak to us.
What has he cut? I mean, has he been worse than Reagan as far as cutting things?
Well, at SUNY, particularly, is affected most by New York State cuts. Every year we go through crises where so many teachers will have to be fired, so many staff members. This year, I think the current number we're looking at is maybe 400 cuts, and that'll be politically bounced back and forth. But we're losing teachers every year. We're losing staff members every year, so the quality of the education and the quality of the service here is going down. At the same point, the state is pushing Stony Brook as the great university it can be, although they're saying it is, and it's the university that Stony Brook could be if they would put enough attention into it.
Uh-huh. In addition to campus events, the Stony Brook Press, I understand, is trying to become a kind of community paper as well. Could you explain how you intend to do that?
Well, we're very interested in community events, particularly in this county legislator thing. I've spoken to Mr. Cohalland, to Mr. Halpin. We're very interested with that race. A lot of Stony Brook students, of course, being Suffolk residents, all are very concerned with things like Shoreham, with other county matters, and we get involved there. We cover the elections.
But again, there are Suffolk County residents that can't vote, at least if their hometown isn't in Suffolk, they can't vote.
This is true. This is a long-standing problem with college residents in literally every university. They're not, although they live, for instance, we live at Stony Brook for 9 months a year, but we can't vote here. Some residents who live in Suffolk or who can get home to Nassau, often can get a chance to vote. But residents who live further than that really can't get a chance to vote.
And the school does not give a day off for Election Day.
And Election Day is a school day, which makes it doubly bad.
That hasn't always been.
No, it hasn't. I don't know when they started school on Election Day. Every year, I understand there are motions made in the University Senate, which is the faculty body, the faculty's governing body, saying there should be a day off on Election Day, but there never is, because, actually, I don't know why, but it's something administration decides.
One thing that's almost traditional here on Stony Brook campus is the calendar fight. There have been more calendars than there have been years, I think, in the last 4 years. Do you know anything about that, about what the arguments were for changing calendars and why this is happening?
Well, this is something we've been very involved in for the last 4 years. The calendar you're referring to, basically the length of the semesters and when final exams would be. The university in 1980 and 1981 had a 13-week semester, which is the minimum that state law requires. In that 13-week semester would be similar to what the university had before, which was a 15-week semester. Students were given, although it seems change from 15 to 13 weeks would not be very much, in fact it did load down students with a considerably greater amount of work every week, and certainly hurt the ability of students to get involved in any sort of extracurricular or co-curricular activities. Also, there were a great deal of controversy on this. A lot of the faculty members liked the shortened semester because it gave them more time to do research and they didn't have to work as much on teaching. But at the same time, a lot of faculty members who were very concerned with the quality of their teaching wanted to keep the semester its original length. In the last 2 years, the semester has been moved back to 15 weeks, although there have been suggestions that have been made, say, instead of from August to December, as it currently is, from September into January, for instance, with final exams being made after the Christmas break. The current calendar we have now seems to be a relatively happy one, and although there are certainly problems with it, I don't think we have much of a chance of seeing a better one soon.
An issue I've seen the Stony Brook Press devote a lot of time to in the last few years is the possible arming of public safety or university police, as they call themselves here on campus. It seems as if the position of the press has always been against arming these people. On what is that based?
Well, you're right. The press has always been against the arming of the university police here. And this has always been a perennial controversy since, again, this was a time about 20 years ago before the university officially had a president. The university, the campus security officers were in fact armed for about 5 years after the university was formed. And then the dean of students, a position currently similar to our vice president for student affairs, who was at that point in charge of the university, because as I said, there was no president, disarmed the security officers because he felt that this academic environment did not call for arming.
Now, what year was that?
I believe it was 1964. Since then, and continuing up to today, there's been a call on the part of, largely on the part of the public safety officers, but also certain administrators, even certain faculty and students, although in large measure the faculty and the students are opposed to it, in favor of arming the public safety officers here.
What is that based on? Why do they want to arm them?
Well, the arguments in favor of arming go that university security officers, of which there are currently about 100 on our campus, know the campus better than the Suffolk County Police, who would have to be called in the event of a dangerous situation. They're more familiar with the students, and that they would be able to arrive at a dangerous situation much faster than the Suffolk County Police, who have to come from wherever they happen to be patrolling off campus. Now, we at the press, along with many, many others, feel that the dangers here at Stony Brook are not at such a level that arming is called for, that in fact arming 100 people on campus, be they police officers or not, would increase the tension level, increase the danger level far more than it would, than any benefits that could possibly accrue from that. And we've always opposed it.
Mm-hmm. They say that there's a need for it because there's more crime of sorts, and you say there isn't more crime. Are there examples of more incidents or not? Have things been happening? Have there been guns on campus brought in by other people?
Well, there have been some. In any community, there will be gun incidents over the years. No Stony Brook student has ever been killed in a gun-related crime here at Stony Brook. There have been gun incidents. There was at least one last year in which a gun was discharged, was fired inside, actually outside a campus party. But it's questionable whether the security officers would be able to do anything in most gun situations. You just imagine yourself being a security officer dealing with a student situation. Even if the worst could happen, and in the midst of a crowd of students, someone had a gun and was threatening the lives of the people around them, there's not a whole lot you can do, even if you do have a gun. The dangers of shooting at the criminal are that you will kill innocent students, and certainly in a place as basically crowded as the university, that's almost always going to be the situation.
Uh-huh.
We feel that the university is served very, very adequately by our current security force when situations are such that more armaments are needed. The Suffolk County Police can be called up whenever we need them.
Now, why would we need the Suffolk County Police if that argument holds out, though, that using guns wouldn't do any good? You'd only be, you know, threatening innocent people. So why do we even need the Suffolk County Police?
Well, you can never foresee every conceivable circumstance, and there are imaginable circumstances when you would want your officers to have guns. We feel that as a day-to-day matter, these incidents don't occur. They occur extremely rarely, if at all. And in those unforeseeable circumstances, greater police force is available, literally a phone call away. Even less than that, it's actually a radio call and takes considerably less time. But as a day-to-day event, we don't feel very strongly that guns are not needed here.
Once again, our telephone number is 246-7901. If you have any questions or comments for Joe Capone, the editor of the Stony Brook Press. The program is Chatterbox. We'll be with you until 3:30 p.m. And speaking about the university police or campus security, what are they called? What's their official name?
That's a long story.
Why don't you tell it to us?
Up to a few years ago, they were referred to as security, capital S.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, as they are given the training of police officers, they changed their name from security, which they considered to be kind of a night watchman type role. They felt they had taken on greater status and they deserved a coincident name change. They went on to be called public safety, which perhaps best describes the role they are, or at least should be doing at Stony Brook. That is ensuring the safety of the students, the faculty, the staff at Stony Brook. In the last year, they have quite by themselves, without referring to any other body, to their superiors in the administration, changed the name to University Police. University Task Force Committee that met for the last year recommended that the name be changed back to public safety, as that was a much better description of their job, in that they weren't here as university police. They were here to ensure the public safety. But even now, if you phone them up, they will answer university police.
They will.
And I've heard stories of officers who take great umbrage if you refer to them as security officers or even public safety.
Okay, let's find out once and for all, okay? I'm just going to make a little phone call here. We'll see what they answer the phone with and what they're really called, okay? This should just take a moment. Now, they don't have a non-emergency number, so every number you call them at is the same. It goes in. So I'll just ask them what their official name is.
University Police, Sergeant Fleming.
All right. Yes, can you just tell me what the official name of University Police is? Is it University Police or Campus Security?
Department of Public Safety.
Department of Public Safety. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I wonder why I didn't answer the phone that way. Well, we have a phone call, so let's go to that. Yes. USB, you are on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know what Mr. Capone thinks is the one change that could be made that would improve the quality of life for students in the dorms the most. Would like expansion of the dorm cooking program or elimination of it, or what does he think is the one thing that should be done?
I would say it'd be a philosophical change. That is, letting the students that live there decide how they want to live. There's been a great interest on the part of a lot of the residence life officials at creating an atmosphere for certain effects, making an environment that's socially good. We feel this is basically silly. We'd prefer students to decide themselves what kind of buildings they want. There are 26 buildings on campus, and if the students in one building want it to be a quiet building where they can study, then they should have the right to make it that kind of building. If another building likes to have lots of parties at night but kind of quiet during the day, then that's fine. If another building is very into intramural sports, it should have that option instead of trying to ensure uniformity all across campus, because there are no uniform students. There shouldn't be uniform buildings.
But it's already that way in some cases. I mean, take Amin. Now, Amin's known as a very quiet college, as opposed to Irving, where that is a pretty much a party college.
Well, different buildings. This is, I'd say, not as true as it used to be. Irving used to have a pub in it, and Amin didn't. Now, neither of them have pubs in it because of a number of forces, both in the administration and in the state bureaucracy at large. For instance, now both buildings are locked up at night. I believe Amin, which is one of our quieter buildings, was always locked at night just to increase security, to prevent people from going in. Other buildings, people just get more visitors. They like to keep their doors open at night so that people can come visit them, and this option has, in large measure, been taken away.
Do you think students have ample opportunity to do this through the ledges or to decide how they want to make the buildings?
Well, there are avenues for students to voice their concerns, but I think in large measure, unless the administration changes the way it looks at students at Stony Brook, these avenues are going to be largely ineffective, except for maybe an occasional victory here or there.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling. Our number is 246-7901. Our guest is Joe Capone, editor of the Stony Brook Press. And you did mention that there are many different types of buildings and things like that. Stony Brook seems to be that kind of a place where there's a lot of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the reasons why you decided to come here?
Yeah, yes, as a matter of fact, it was. Well, when I was in high school, I was rather ignorant and really didn't know what I was getting into here. It's only as time has gone on that I've realized what a special place Stony Brook is. I've visited a number of other universities, both Ivy League, like Columbia and Cornell and even Harvard, and many other just kind of plain universities, and Stony Brook has a lot of things that none of them have, and it's special and should be kept that way.
Got another call. Let's go right to it. USB, you're on the air.
Hi, I just have a comment. I just want something cleared up. Mr. Capone just said a little while ago that the visiting options are taken away from the students who have the buildings locked at night. Am I correct in assuming that that was said?
Well, it limits your accessibility. You can't just decide to go visit a friend at 11 o'clock.
Right, but it's not there to take away a visiting option. It's there to make sure that unauthorized or people who aren't supposed to be visiting don't.
Oh, certainly, I understand what you're saying, but I feel that each building should be able to decide for itself. This measure was implemented campus-wide without any student input.
Well, there's not a whole lot of security on the campus now that I can see. I mean, our gates are open 24 hours. There's no check-in when you walk in the building. There's no one sitting in the front of the building to watch who comes in and out. And I think it's a great idea.
So
people who visit have to call ahead, that's all. It's not such a big imposition.
I assume you live on campus.
Yes, I do.
Do you feel in danger at all?
Well, I don't feel safe with the doors being open all night long as they used to be. I feel a little better that they're locked and only people with keys can come in. Or if you can have a visitor late at night, they can just call and you can run down and let them in.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm certainly in favor of that. I think any building that chooses to be locked should certainly have that right. A building that chooses not to be locked should have the option not to do that.
Yeah, but I don't see this university really taking care of its people that way. I mean, I think they should put forth certain security measures and say, look, the buildings are going to be locked, or we're going to have somebody sitting and making sure who goes in and out is supposed to be. Or just keeping record of who goes in and out.
Well,
there's not a whole lot of that. Now, I was really glad to see that they said, look, the buildings are going to be locked at such and such a time.
You mentioned a period where the campus used to be, used to have a gate and wouldn't let anybody in unless they were affiliated with the university.
Well, I wasn't here then. I don't know too much about that.
Do you think?
I know our gates are open all the time, right?
There aren't any gates anymore, yeah.
Well, our entrances are.
Do you think such a system could work?
Well, I certainly think we need more security than there is. I don't really know anything about the gate system. I'm not familiar with that. But I think more security is definitely great.
Do you want to see more security on the part of the students?
I would like to see someone sitting at night watching the doors to the dorms and just taking ID numbers as they go in and out. Not to see who goes in and out. I mean, not so much to make sure who goes in comes out, but to make sure who goes in, they know, have a record of who's in and who's out.
What about the Department of Public Safety, University Police, whatever they're called? Do you want to see an increase in them as well? Do you think there's a need for that?
As far as what?
As far as increased security in the dormitories.
You mean have them be the ones that are sitting out?
Yeah.
Well, whoever, even if they had students on work study. You know, just somebody to sit at the door to take ID numbers as people walk in.
So it doesn't take a particular type of skill or anything to do this?
I don't think so.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Our phone number is 246-7901. Program is Chatterbox. We'll be with you for about another 10 minutes. And our guest is the editor of the Stony Brook Press, Joe Capone. Now, Joe, regarding this whole security issue in the dormitories, there was a plan for at least one building that was absolutely definitely supposed to be in service by September. And, of course, no move whatsoever has been made to doing this. That was some sort of an electronic system where everybody had their own special ID card and everyone would have a special combination electronic lock on their door. And from what I was hearing, I don't know if this is getting open to wild rumors or something, but I heard you didn't even have to take the card out of your pocket when you walked in the door, that it would be able to sense a card somewhere on your person and identify you as being the person walking through the door. So if John Smith walks through the door at a particular time, it would open for him because it sees the card in his pocket with magnetic whatevers on it. What do you know about that?
I'm not acquainted with the technology, but one of our buildings, I believe it was Irving, but I'm not sure, or one or two of our buildings, were going to get a certain passkey arrangement where through some electronic means you register your presence at the door, and you can then get in. People without the pass keys wouldn't be able to get in. This is, while certainly a good technology, an incredibly expensive one. I recall it being quoted at something like $100,000 per building. Certainly far more expensive than any more reasonable security measure would cost. I remember when I have friends at Columbia University, which is in the upper east side of New York, in a very dangerous neighborhood. And in those buildings, they have two different security measures. The buildings that are located on campus, actually within the Columbia Preserve, are just have a guard at the an unarmed guard at the main entrance, and any student going in or out has to present identification in order to get up, or has to be brought up by a resident student from that building. The buildings that are further off campus have this sort of passkey arrangement. They actually have not a passkey, but it's you can call up, and each room has a button that will unlock the front door, and you can call up on an intercom and have whoever you're visiting let you into the building. One of the problems at Stony Brook that was mentioned by the lady that called a little while ago is, in a lot of cases, is that a lot of students don't have telephones, and you can't call them up and have them come and let you into the building. At Columbia, this was done by an intercom system, which every room had.
Not only that, but there are supposed to be what we call campus phones that are free phones that call other campus phones. In the Student Union building, there isn't a single one of those for general use by the public. There used to be two, maybe three of them, and they've been vanishing. And I don't really understand the logic behind that. It seems that campus phones are a necessity. Otherwise, people have to spend money calling something that's supposed to be free.
Well, not only do they provide the access for people, both students and non-students, to call around campus, but they also provide emergency service in that you can immediately get to a free phone. You don't have to look for a dime if you want to call up the ambulance.
Right. If I had to call up an ambulance or public safety or something from the Student Union building, and I didn't have a dime, there would be no way I could do it unless I called them collect and they accepted charges or something. There are no campus phones in order to do something like that, and I hate to think of the day when someone's going to be faced with that difficult moment. You know?
There are campus phones scattered in buildings across campus, but they're not there uniformly unless you happen to specifically know a specific phone location. You can't go there. They're not in the same place in every building, and they don't always work.
246-7901 is our number. Let's go to this call.
Right now, may I take a message?
USB.
Yeah, could
you? Uh-oh. Well, we won't interrupt them, whatever they're talking about. 246-7901 is our phone number. We have about 6 minutes left. There is kind of a new service starting on campus. Actually, it's been here for a while, and that's the campus dorm patrol, or the student dorm patrol. What's it called exactly?
It's
the volunteer
resident dorm patrol, and it's part of a greater student-run service. It's been in existence. It actually went through metamorphosed in several forms. It was started by residents in our Kelly Quad as a volunteer program. It worked out so well it became, it went on a larger scale. It became supported by public safety in terms of giving them walkie-talkies and jackets and things like that. And now there's a program where students on college work study are paid for patrolling the campus. And this is, I think, in large measure, a very good program. They provide a number of other services besides walking around campus, basically patrolling as the eyes of public safety, to provide handicap programs and the like.
Now, a lot of the people who are involved in this volunteer dorm patrol have expressed support for the idea of giving guns to public safety. Now, do you see a parallel there?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true. Certainly some of the leaders of the program, the various programs, have favored arming public safety, but I've spoken to at least as many of those same people who are opposed to arming public safety. And I don't think it's necessarily indicative of the feeling of the group as a whole.
Mm-hmm. How about the group of public safety as a whole? Do you think they want to arm themselves?
Well, I think in large measure most public safety officers want to be armed, and I can in large measure sympathize with their position. They're trained as policemen, and they're doing in large measure the work of policemen, so they feel they should be armed as policemen.
Is it a social status thing for them?
It's a lot of them feel it's a social status. I was talking to one public safety officer a year ago who told me how ashamed he was when a little girl came up to him and said, "Are you a policeman?" And he said, "Yes." And the little girl went, "Well, where's your gun?" Uh-huh. It's a status thing, but it's a status thing for many of them, but not all. Some of them legitimately want to be armed as a way to provide greater security. And it's not that we don't like public safety. We like the officers in large measure. We think they do a fine job. We just don't feel the campus situation calls for arming.
Mm-hmm. And you feel most of the campus is behind you in this?
It's various polls that have been taken in the papers and through Polity Hotline and through the University Senate, which is the faculty. The faculty Senate voted unanimously against arming, and student polls show similar feeling.
We have one more call that we'll have time for. USB, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd just like to make a comment. As a former Stony Brook Press reporter, I did an interview with Gary Barnes when he first came to the campus, and he made a remark that the public safety are thrilled when they get a new toy. He was speaking at the time about their new clubs that were made to resemble guns, and that was initially to buy them off so that they wouldn't continue to want arms. But then in another article with a public safety lieutenant, he made it very clear that they can't do their jobs unless they're armed. So that, you know, I'd just like to clear up that that's their position. They definitely desire arms, regardless of what they say.
Well, thanks very much for sharing that with us.
Sure, no problem.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Well, how about administration? What do you think? Does administration in favor of all this?
Well, when quoted, they say they won't be and that they aren't. A decision on arming rests ultimately with the president of the university, and he seems to be opposed to arming. Our two vice presidents concerned with that have been previously stated they were against arming, but just recently they've come out in favor of a limited arming program where officers who transported payroll, for instance, would be armed. We feel this is basically just a step towards a total arming.
Well, Joe, we're out of time, but there's one thing I'd just like you to tell our listeners. If students out there notice things that are going wrong, like walls that are about to fall down and fire hazards and things like that, and the administration is not being responsive, what can they do?
Well, there are a number of avenues. The first is to work through polity, through either their building representatives or by themselves, or to call up the Stony Brook Press, the university's weekly newspaper, at 246-6832, and we'll see what we can do about it.
Okay, you mentioned Polity Hotline. What's their phone number?
Polity Hotline is available for any of a vast variety of complaints. They're 246-4000.
Okay. Joe Capone, editor of the press, good luck to you in the coming years, and good luck to the press. Thanks for being with us today on Chatterbox. And that is our program for today. We'll be back next Monday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Next Monday, we'll have Robert Matheson, who is the independent candidate for Suffolk County Executive. And he also is in charge of various nightclubs, such as the OBI East. And if you have any questions for him, you can give us a call at 246-7901. Be sure to tune in tomorrow afternoon for Art Dietrich and his business program. That's Tuesday afternoons at 2:30 p.m. And every weekday afternoon at 2:30, we have a call-in program right here on WUSB Stony Brook. I'm Eric Corley. Until next week, bye-bye.
October 31st. The tiny star cluster Pleiades has a dark association with Halloween. More about it after this.